And our first presentation, we have Gregory Bennett.
Thank you. Today we're going to talk about God's providence in nature. And I want to focus on earth science because that's what I teach and that's what my background's in. But it's an example of God's providence. And it's to talk more about what is God's providence and how does that relate to earth science. How does the earth change over time and how does providence relate to that? And then some of the challenges around the idea of working with God's providence. So why is God's providence important and why even use the term? Well, providence talks about God's activity in the universe. Without God's providence, there wouldn't be any created anything. Nothing would exist. There'd be no mathematics, no gravity, no light, no life. Because God's providence is the basis for science. God's providence is the foundation for technology. And it's appropriate to talk about God's providence. As the basis for science, God has made and continues to sustain a universe that acts in predictable ways. If a scientific experiment gives a certain result today, then we can have confidence, if all the factors are the same, it will give the same result tomorrow or 100 years from tomorrow. Theologically, the reason that's a true statement is because of the doctrine of God's providence. As far as the foundation for technology, I can be confident that gasoline will make my car run today just as it did yesterday, not simply because it has always worked that way, but because God's providence sustains a universe in which created things maintain the properties with which he created them. So, obviously, God's providence is important for science. Let's just define what God's providence is so we're on the same wavelength. God's continually involved with all created things in such a way that he, first of all, there's three things he does as part of the doctrine of God's providence. He preserves or keeps all created things existing and maintaining the properties with which he created them. He also cooperates with created things in every action and directs their distinctive properties to cause them to act as they do. And he governs. God has a purpose in all that he does in the world, and that he providentially governs or directs all things in order that they accomplish his purposes. So those are the three aspects of God's providence, just to define that. Now, from a scripture standpoint, some scripture talks about God's providence in that in Colossians 1:16 and 17, he says, Paul writes, "For all things in heaven and on earth were created by him. All things were created through him and for him. He is himself is before all things, and all things are held together in him." So these verses talk about both doctrines, doctrine of creation and the doctrine of God's providence. In Hebrews 1, 2, and 3, it talks about both doctrines as well. "In these last days he has spoken to us in a son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom he created the world," or in Greek, eons, which is an interesting, cool idea as a geologist. "Through whom he created the world, the Son sustains all things by his powerful word." So creation and sustaining. I proposed in an ASA meeting a few years back what is called, what I like to call an active or distinct model of God's providence. And what we see in this model is a vertical line where God is actively, personally active at the top, or inactive or irrelevant at the bottom. And then in the other line, God is indistinct from nature on the left, and distinct from nature on the right. If God is personally active but indistinct from nature, we call that pantheism, and an example of pantheism might be the movie Avatar. If God is irrelevant or indistinct from nature, or doesn't exist, we might call that materialism. In other words, all that exists is nature, and you see that in the red box, whereas pantheism, you see both God and nature, but it's in the same. It exists as the same in pantheism. In deism, in the red box of what exists, you have God and nature, but notice the difference is, yes, God is distinct from nature, But God is inactive or irrelevant. In other words, God is not working in nature today. In theism, similar to deism, God and nature are separate. However, God is personally active. So the bottom line of my talk today is if we are a theist and not some other quadrant, we must consider God as being personally active today, now, and for all of the universe and history, active in nature, and not just delegating everything to some other action. So that's the bottom line of where I'm going on this. And I've called this pastoral considerations because I believe apologetics at their root are pastoral, except apologetics only work for Myers-Briggs types that are the thinking Myers-Briggs types. So we talk people into going to becoming Christians because they're Myers-Briggs type of thinking personalities. And so by apologetics, we're actually loving them by loving up on them and arguing with them. So this is apologetics, but it's actually pastoral for thinking type personalities. So, okay, let's talk about the theological mechanisms for change. Okay? If theologians and pastors don't talk about God's providence in nature and get that concept in the popular Christian worldview, they give people in the pew no theological mechanism for God to make the change in nature. Earth science is all about how God makes changes in nature, so that's why earth science is a good example. We must be talking about God's providence in nature in our churches and in our work. Now, we can't obviously write scientific papers about like that, but we can with people we know, and we can with our conversations. Basically, it's taking what we already know and study and bringing God into the discussion and not leaving him out of our sentences. So here's the problem with ignoring God's providence. You have creation versus evolution, and both paint themselves into a corner by ignoring this doctrine. From a creation standpoint, without God's providence, the creationist thinkers have no mechanism to explain the tightly knit relationship between God and nature that scientists observe. They resort to explaining any change in nature to God's direct creative handiwork and cannot model God's involvement otherwise. Whereas from an evolution standpoint, without God's providence, evolutionists have no mechanism to tie what they observe in nature to the person of God. And they run the risk of modeling evolutionary mechanisms as self-perpetuating ones and supporting worldviews that do not include a personal, active, involved God. In other words, don't support theism. So let's look at earth science and look at the scriptures that support this active, personal model, i.e. theistic model of God. Well, earth science is the queen of systems. God uses interactions of systems over time to make changes on the earth. And these interactions are between geosphere, biosphere, hydrosphere, atmosphere, and exosphere when it relates to the earth and sun and space. And let's look at some scripture around each of those parts of earth science. First of all, Psalm 65 brings up all of those spheres. You created the mountains by your power and demonstrated your strength. Geosphere. You calm the raging sea and the roaring waves, hydrosphere. Even those living in the remote areas are awestruck by your acts. You cause those living to the east and west to praise you, exosphere. We don't have an east and west without a spinning world. You visit the earth and give it rain. You make it rich and fertile with overflowing streams full of water. You provide a grain for them. You prepare the earth to yield its crops, biosphere. You saturate its furrows and soak up its plowed ground. With rain showers, you soften its soil and make its crops grow. Atmosphere. And by the way, notice that the tense of the language is in present tense. The meadows are clothed with sheep and the valleys are covered with grain. They shout joyfully, yes, they sing. So creation responds to a God that's involved with his creation. So earth history is all about God's providence. I love this verse because as a scientist, it's the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the glory of scientists to search out a matter. So that's kind of my mantra as a scientist. Okay, let's kind of apply this to the geologic timescale to start with. Okay? Geologists learn to think in a different paradigm than those who think in terms of days, months, and years. We think in terms of eons, eras, and periods. I've already quoted Hebrews 1:2 earlier. Hebrews 11:3 uses the same Greek word. So it's translated worlds, but it's actually eons. It's a term that means time and space, not just worlds. By faith, we understand that the eons were set forth in God's, in order at God's command, so that the visible has its origin in the invisible. So things are in order by God's command. He sets his providence in motion. Okay? Geologists study the effects of God's hand working through time to use wind and waves to make sedimentary rocks. And like the disciples, we have the opportunity to say as geologists, even the wind and waves obey him. So, and Jesus in Luke 8:24-25, so he got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waves. They died down. It was calm. And he said to them, where's your faith? But they were afraid and amazed, saying to one another, who is this? He commands even the wind and the water, and they obey him. So we see Jesus doing what Jesus has always done through geologic time. We see him commanding the wind and the waves. By studying sedimentary rocks, geologists have the opportunity to study how God's hand has used wind and waves or wind and water to make them through geologic time. We're studying, when we pick up a rock, and this is what I taught my kids all growing up, when I look at a rock, I'm looking at the hand of God crafting that rock and personally doing what's in that rock. I'm not looking at something he started and it just ran on its own. I'm looking at God actively as an engineer and an artist making what I see in that rock. So everything I study as a geologist is looking at a divine action, which is why geology is so much fun. By studying fossils, what geologists do is they have an opportunity to understand the ways that God managed the ecosystems in which they lived. God is managing the ecosystems where his critters live throughout geologic time. And throughout the history of the earth, God has had lots of extinctions, five major extinctions, where he's decided to redecorate the room. You know, he has a house, he's decorated one way, and my wife does this. She'll come in and want to change the seasons. So we have Christmas decorations. He changes the seasons. Then we have Valentine decorations. He changes the seasons. Then we have Easter decorations. Change the seasons. Then the summer is the seashell time. Summer is when we get to look at all the ocean stuff. And then we start into the fall with the, she doesn't like Halloween, but we do fall starting in Halloween, kind of do Thanksgiving, Halloween together. It's changing of the seasons. That's exactly what God has actively done with mass extinctions. He's changing the way the world looks. And he's choosing to do that because as a creative artist, he's doing that. That's what artists do. They create. And you could make the point that God has to create because God is a creator, therefore he must create. People say that about love, why not creativity? And we call that God's providence. How many things have you made, O Lord? You have exhibited great skill in making all of them. The earth is full of the living things you have made. When you ignore them, they panic. When you take away their life's breath, they die and return to dust. God is in charge of everything he makes and is actively working with it. Geologists look back in time when God worked in relationship to the world before he created people. They look back in the ancient world just like archaeologists might at an ancient Egyptian tomb or over a Van Gogh. When geologists study a fossil, they see God's engineering. They're looking at one of the pots the potter has made. So here's some potters from a long time ago in India. And the Lord said to Jeremiah, go down at once to the potter's house. I will speak to you further there. So I went down to the potter's house and found him working at his wheel. And there you see a potter working at his wheel with a lump of clay right next to that. Now and then there would be something wrong with the pot he was modeling from the clay with his hands, so we would rework the clay into another kind of pot as he saw fit. Then the Lord said to me, I, the Lord, O nation of Israel, can I not deal with you as this potter deals with the clay? In my hands, you, O nation of Israel, just like the clay in the potter's hands. And that's how God is working through nature, clay in the potter's hands, in our lives as well as lives in everything we study in science. So changes on the earth over time show God's activity on the earth. The earth is stable, it doesn't change, because God made it like a top. It's like a bicycle wheel that rotates quickly, providing a stable place to live. And it says that in Psalm 104:5, He established the earth on its foundations, it'll never be upended. God doesn't change. I, the Lord, do not change in Malachi. And in James 1:7, there's no variation or the slightest hint of change in God. But the geosphere changes. And in Psalm 102:26, they will perish, but you will endure. They will wear out like a garment, like clothes. You will remove them, and they will disappear. God, one of the things I want you to notice as you're going through these is how active God is. And that's the handout I gave you. Basically, that's stuff God is doing on the earth using earth systems. Okay? And so what I'll be doing with the rest of this talk is going through what you're seeing on that those verses of what God is actively doing in the world around us as a theist would think. In other words, it just doesn't happen on its own. So God separated the earth into layers. It's interesting that Job 38:8-11 says something like that. In other words, you shut up the door and it burst forth, coming out like a womb. I made the storm clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band. I prescribed limits and set a place to its bolts and doors when I said, to here you may come no further. Here your proud waves be confined. And I'm taking some liberty on the word waves, but the point is that there's layers in the earth and they're segmented into pieces and they have to be that way because God made the earth as a dynamic earth. Otherwise, it would be like Mars and be a dead planet. The earth takes shape like a clay under its seal. Its features are dyed like a garment. Job 38. I'm going the wrong way. Okay. Job 38:16, have you walked in the springs that are filled with the sea or walked about in the recesses of the deep, implying that God has done that? The waters have covered the mountains. The largest mountain chains on earth are underwater. Psalm 104:6. God created a system so there always be dry land on the earth. Psalm 104:8-9. As the mountains rose up and the valleys went down to the place you appointed them, you set a boundary for them they could not cross so that they would not cover the earth again. What God has set up is that mafic material in the ocean is denser than the felsic material in the continental crust. And the reason we have land is because the felsic material floats. So the continents float on the other material, and whenever you melt the ocean material, it differentially melts and you get lighter material rising up and you get things like diorites and granites or if it's volcanic, andesites or rhyolites. So you get rocks that float on the heavier, denser rocks. He looks at the earth and it trembles. God creates earthquakes. And there we see the ring of fire around the Pacific Ocean where God is actively now creating those earthquakes. He touches the mountains and they smoke. God makes volcanoes blow up. He touches them. It's in the present tense. It's actively happening. Volcanoes don't blow up on their own. There's changes in the biosphere. They wear out like a garment. You will remove them, they'll disappear. The scripture says there's going to be extinctions. There's hydrosphere changes in Job 38. Who carves out a channel for the heavy rains? That's a present tense. The ice emerges. It talks about ice and snow in Job 38:29-30. From whose womb does the ice emerge? God's. And here we see a hydrosphere changes over time. Over the last 500,000 years, there's been a number of ice ages. There's atmosphere changes. Notice the present tense. He gives rain to the earth and it sends water on the fields. Now, all this scripture doesn't prove anything. That's why it's called pastoral considerations. It's really encouraging to read in Scripture that God's actively working in the world around us. And that's what we're doing when we quote Scripture to people and blend science, is we're encouraging people to think about having a relationship with God. So here we see a change in oxygen levels on the earth over time. There's exosphere changes. Here we see an asteroid coming toward the earth. And it could be that the destruction of the earth in 2 Peter in the future is an asteroid hits the earth and burns it all up, just like happened 65 million years ago. What would happen if a 10-kilometer near-Earth object collided with the Earth? It would be very destructive. So here's some challenges. Let's speak like theists and not like deists. Let's speak about God's personal activity in nature and not about self-driven mechanisms. Let's think in terms of systems and not of objects. Let's think in terms of God as a potter. Let's think of geologists and archaeologists as, I guess that really should say geologists, as finding out about God's activity in the ancient past. And let's request help from theologians to help us all know how to talk about God's providence in nature, because all the books out there on God's providence talk about people. They don't talk about nature. But let's think about nature in this discussion. So our message is the joy of serving Jesus Christ and his activity in governing the world around us, and that's what we study as geologists. And at Solid Rock Lectures, organization that I work with Ken Wagamuth on in the back, he'll talk later, we talk about this and other subjects with Christian pastors and Bible colleges so that we can teach them about geology. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
We have 5 minutes for questions.
Here you go.
So, Greg, I can't help but say that I'm hearing a very different view of the way God interacts with the world compared to what we heard last night.
Yeah, you are.
And I just wonder if, you know, maybe you don't want to, you know, being controversialist, but I just wondered if you would care to comment about that.
Well, the question I asked last night about Disney was a little bit flippant because I was trying to get a laugh out of people. But I was actually pretty serious because I honestly think that our issue, and I grew up in India and East Africa, I honestly think the issue with modern people is that Disney has changed our view of animals, and a Hindu view of the universe and people and life has changed our culture alongside of that, so that we see animals differently than people saw animals 200 years ago, say. And so the whole question of suffering is no longer suffering of people, it's suffering of anything that is like a dog. A dog's a dog. You know, when it gets old, you put it down. So what? It's a dog. It's not a person. And I think the problem is there's a real danger, and ASA perhaps could help promote a discussion of what does it mean to be human in the image of God as opposed to an animal? What is man as opposed to my pet poodle?
Well, and I think, too, the idea that God is actively crafting in a volcanic eruption. It just seems to me that viewpoint would not have been well received in the last talk.
I've been intrigued with Eugene Merrill's book, Everlasting Dominion. And in that, he proposes as an idea to think about, and that's what we're all about at ASA, did Jesus primarily do his miracles as the perfect man on earth? Therefore, if Adam had not fallen, Adam would be doing those same kind of miracles that Jesus did. Well, if that's true, then when the tornado comes to me, if I had never fallen, I'd say, who cares if a rabbit dies? But if it's my child, that's different. So I could say, be still, wind and waves, and that tornado wouldn't harm my family. Because I still have the authority that God gave me as his representative in his image with dominion over nature that I got twisted and tainted because I fell. And here's the problem with that. I always lose that argument until I bring in the perspective that my wife and I have been reading from Sarah Young's devotional, Jesus Calling, for the last 3 years. She's teaching us in that book to walk through the day with Jesus standing next to me. It's a wonderful teaching to go through that book. Well, if I change that idea, then I'm meant to go through the day with Jesus right here. So it's really Jesus and me that are telling Hurricane Katrina, be still, wind and waves, and they don't bother me. Or the man-eating tiger, that it's not going to bother me. If the man-eating tiger eats a deer, it's a deer. That's what it's meant to do. But if it hurts me, that's different. Or my child. And so I think that's worth exploring because it changes a theodicy a whole lot to say the problems in nature that affect humans are acts of man, not God. That's a different talk, but that's kind of behind this.